From New York, the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, this is Democracy Now!
As we speak, I am dispatching thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers, military personnel, and law enforcement officers to stop the rioting, looting, vandalism, assaults, and the wanton destruction of property.
President Trump threatens to send thousands of heavily armed soldiers into the country's streets to quell nationwide protests against police brutality. One senator described Trump's threat as a declaration of war against American citizens. We'll go to D.C. for the latest and then to Minneapolis, where two autopsies have agreed George Floyd's death at the hands of Minneapolis police was a homicide. Plus, we go to Los Angeles to speak with Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors, author of the memoir, When They Call You a Terrorist.
Consistent policing, militarized policing. I witnessed the impact mass incarceration had on my family members. And the most early memories for me were my home being raided by LAPD.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As a historic uprising against police violence continues across the United States, President Trump Monday threatened to send heavily armed soldiers into the country's streets.
Mayors and governors must establish an overwhelming law enforcement presence until the violence has been quelled. If a city or state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them.
As Trump spoke from the Rose Garden, blasts could be heard from nearby Lafayette Park as the National Guard and police fired tear gas, rubber bullets, flashbangs to disperse a peaceful protest against police brutality. Many officers wore riot gear. Some were on horseback. Moments later, Trump walked through the now cleared park to have his photo taken with a Bible in front of St. John's Episcopal Church, which was boarded up. Trump was accompanied by Attorney General William Barr, Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, and Defense Secretary Mark Esper. The president's actions were widely denounced. The D.C. Episcopal Bishop, Marianne Edgar Buddy, criticized Trump for using the church as a, quote, backdrop for a message antithetical to the teachings of Jesus, end quote. The chief of police in Arlington, Virginia, pulled his officers from D.C. after they were used to clear the park, saying their safety and the safety of others was endangered for a photo op. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon wrote on Twitter, quote, "The fascist speech Donald Trump just delivered verged on a declaration of war against American citizens," unquote. Protests against police violence continue to rage across the country as well. Thousands have been arrested, including 2,000 people in Los Angeles alone. Cities across the country have imposed curfews. 23 states have called in the National Guard. Protests have also spread across the globe, reaching France, Germany, Australia, and New Zealand, among many other countries. The European Union's top diplomat said the EU is shocked and appalled by George Floyd's killing, calling it an abuse of power by police. The protests began a week ago after a white police officer in Minneapolis pinned African-American George Floyd to the ground by his neck for over 8 minutes while Floyd gasped for air repeatedly, saying, "I can't breathe." Two separate autopsies Monday confirmed Floyd's death was a homicide. The officer, Derek Chauvin, was charged Friday with third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. Three other officers who were also at the scene have been fired but not charged. Two of them held them down with Chauvin. The other acted as a lookout. George Floyd's memorial service is planned for Thursday in Minneapolis. His funeral is scheduled for next Tuesday in Houston. Meanwhile, NBC News reports Minneapolis police records show officers used neck restraints over 230 times over the last 5 years and made at least 44 people unconscious. In other news, Louisville, Kentucky Police Chief Steve Conrad has been fired after it emerged two officers who were at the scene of a fatal shooting early Monday morning did not have their body cameras activated, a violation of police department policy. Both police and the National Guard fired shots at a crowd Monday, which killed David McAtee, whose body then reportedly lay in the streets of Louisville for over 12 hours. David McAtee owned a local barbecue business, was a beloved figure in the community who regularly gave police officers free meals. Louisville Police Chief Steve Conrad had already announced his plan to retire this month in the wake of the Louisville police killing of Breonna Taylor, a 26-year-old African-American woman shot to death by police inside her own apartment in March. Taylor was an EMT, an emergency room technician, as well as aspiring nurse. Here in New York City, protests continue into the night in defiance of an 11 p.m. curfew imposed Monday, the city's first curfew since 1943. Earlier in the day, protesters held a die-in in Times Square. In Oakland, California, an estimated 15,000 people attended a massive youth march against police brutality. This is organizer Akil Riley addressing a sea of students, educators, and parents outside Oakland Technical High School.
It lives off poor people in this capitalist society. People need to be oppressed for America to work. So don't believe that that police are fighting crime. They're brainwashed. They're merely an arm of oppression. Why would a system of government work to combat crime? No, they work to make money. If America was really against crime, they would give people access to health care and housing and education.
Shortly before the countywide 8 p.m. curfew began, police began shooting tear gas, flashbang grenades, and rubber bullets at demonstrators in front of Oakland Police Department headquarters. Shortly after 8 p.m., police kettled protesters, made several group arrests, many of them for curfew violations. Meanwhile, public health experts and government officials are warning protests could lead to new surges of COVID-19 infections. The coronavirus has already killed black people in America at a disproportionately high rate. Activists are calling for justice for James Scurlock, a 22-year-old black man who was fatally shot Saturday night by a white bar owner in Omaha, Nebraska, during anti-police brutality protests. Prosecutors said Monday, bar owner Jake Gardner will not face charges because he appeared to act in self-defense in surveillance footage of the shooting. But others say James Scurlock was attempting to de-escalate a scuffle outside the bar, which started after Gardner and his father provoked a crowd and Gardner fired his gun. A Facebook post by Jake Gardner, a 38-year-old ex-Marine, just hours before the killing reads, quote, "Just when you think, what else could 2020 throw at me? Then you have to pull 48 hours of military-style fire watch." Gardner has been arrested on criminal charges at least four times, including once for third-degree assault. He's also faced accusations of discriminating against black patrons and making transphobic comments. Facebook workers staged a virtual walkout Monday in solidarity with the nationwide demonstrations and to protest Facebook's handling of Trump posts that they say, quote, incite violence. Last week, Twitter placed a warning on a Trump post that included the phrase, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts," saying it violated rules about glorifying violence. But Facebook and CEO Mark Zuckerberg declined to take action on the same post, despite concerns voiced by a growing number of its staff. An Iranian scientist who contracted COVID-19 while imprisoned in a U.S. immigration jail is being deported today. Cyrus Asghari was imprisoned for years despite being acquitted in a trade secrets case. Before becoming infected, Asghari pleaded for his freedom and called out the unsanitary and inhumane conditions inside the Wynn Correctional Center in Louisiana, where he was being held. As global coronavirus cases top 6.2 million and deaths surpass 375,000, countries around the world continue to ease restrictions even as the World Health Organization warns premature reopenings could cause a new wave of infections. In Bangladesh, the first Rohingya refugee has died of COVID-19. The 71-year-old had been living in Cox's Bazar, the world's largest refugee camp, home to a million Rohingya. This comes as Bangladesh reported nearly 3,000 new cases nationwide in the past day, the highest daily number yet. In India, more than 2 months after it imposed the world's largest lockdown, many businesses and services reopened Monday. This comes despite the registered increase in coronavirus cases. Hotels, restaurants, shopping malls and places of worship may also reopen as of next week. In Britain, many grade schools started holding in-person classes again this week as Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government also eases other restrictions, including allowing small gatherings outdoors. Some are objecting to what they say is a rush to end the lockdown, with many parents opting to hold back their children from attending. Infections are trending downward, but Britain still reports around 4,000 new cases every day and has registered close to 40,000 COVID deaths. This comes as teacher unions in South Africa are urging staff to defy government orders to reopen schools this week, saying schools do not have enough personal protective equipment or resources to keep educators and students safe. South Africa has reported 35,000 coronavirus cases, while the African continent has surpassed 150,000 infections. The United Nations is appealing for $2.4 billion to carry out humanitarian operations in Yemen as the nation faces a dual tragedy fueled by the coronavirus and years of devastating war. Save the Children warns over 5 million Yemenis are at risk of losing access to food and clean water. An international pledging conference hosted by the UN and Saudi Arabia is taking place today. The U.S.-backed Saudi-led war in Yemen has created the world's worst humanitarian disaster. Data from intensive care units suggest 20% of patients treated for COVID-19 in Yemen are dying, compared with a global average of 7%. While Yemen officially has registered around 350 cases and over 80 deaths, Yemen has one of the lowest testing rates in the world, and the true toll is expected to be much higher. The Environmental Protection Agency gutted parts of the Clean Water Act Monday when it finalized a rule restricting the ability of states and tribes to block federal energy projects such as pipelines or industrial plants that could pollute rivers and drinking water. Lisa Felt of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation said, quote, "This rule is an egregious assault on states' longstanding authority to safeguard the quality of their own waters. Despite the Trump administration's professed respect for cooperative federalism, it's clearly willing to steamroll states' rights and greenlight major construction projects with no regard for how they might damage state waters." And in climate news, Siberia is experiencing a record-breaking heat wave. Some parts of the region registered temperatures more than 20 degrees higher than the historic average for this time of year. Wildfires are expected to intensify into the summer, as scientists warn the mounting temperatures are speeding the thawing of the permafrost, which releases carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, causing temperatures to further rise. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez from his home in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and good day to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we have so much to do today as an historic week-long uprising against police violence continues and curfews are in place across the United States. President Trump's declared himself the president of law and order and threatened Monday to send thousands of heavily armed soldiers into the streets.
If a city or state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them. I am also taking swift and decisive action to protect our great capital, Washington, D.C. What happened in this city last night was a total disgrace. As we speak, I am dispatching thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers, military personnel, and law enforcement officers to stop the rioting, looting, vandalism, assaults, and the wanton destruction of property.
While Trump spoke from the Rose Garden, blasts could be heard from nearby Lafayette Park as the National Guard and officers dressed in riot gear fired tear gas, rubber bullets, and flashbangs to disperse peaceful protesters. Moments later, Trump walked through the cleared park to have his photo taken with a Bible in front of St. John's Episcopal Church, which was boarded up. When he returned to the White House, Trump refused to take questions from reporters as he pumped his fist and posed for another photo op.
Mr. President, what are you doing about excessive police use of force?
Mr. President, is this still a democracy?
That last reporter saying, Mr. President, is this still a democracy? The president's actions were widely denounced. D.C. Episcopal Bishop Marianne Edgar Buddy criticized Trump for using the church as a, quote, backdrop for a message antithetical to the teachings of Jesus, unquote. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden wrote on Twitter, quote, the fascist speech Donald Trump just delivered verged on a declaration of war against American citizens. The chief of police in Arlington County, Virginia, pulled his officers from D.C. after they were used to clear the park, saying their safety and the safety of others was endangered for a photo op. This is police and the National Guard clearing peaceful protesters from the streets of Washington, D.C. before the 7 p.m. curfew. Fence has now been erected around Lafayette Park across from the White House. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and in Irvington, New York, William Arkin is with us, a longtime reporter on military and nuclear policy, author of many books, including Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Kristen Clark, let's begin with you. Your concerns about Donald Trump's speech last night, saying he's deploying thousands and thousands of troops to Washington, D.C., and all over the country to quell the protests.
You know, President Trump's speech almost amounted to a declaration of war on Americans, on peaceful Americans who are out right now exercising their First Amendment right to speak out and here to speak out against the longstanding problem of police violence and racial violence, which has beleaguered our nation. President Trump has invoked the Insurrection Act of 1807. This is a law that has been used in the past to deploy the military to states to deal with, for example, resistance to the desegregation orders that have been put in place for the University of Mississippi. When officials were hostile and recalcitrant, President Kennedy ordered that troops go in to force the state to comply with the law here, the civil rights law that required desegregation. We saw President Bush deploy the military to Louisiana to help with relief efforts after Hurricane Katrina. But that happened in coordination with officials in the state of Louisiana. Here, Trump single-handedly seeks to deploy the military to states all across our country over the objections of state officials and with the sole and singular purpose of silencing Americans. In many ways, this is the death of democracy, because people who are out right now have one singular goal: to ensure that at this moment we not turn our backs on the long overdue work that's necessary to rid our nation of the scourge of police violence that has resulted in innumerable deaths of unarmed African Americans.
Kristen Clark, I'm wondering, you mentioned the 1962 Oxford, Mississippi. There was also in 1958, President Eisenhower sent federal troops into Little Rock, Arkansas, also to enforce desegregation orders in the public schools there. But in the Oxford, Mississippi, the difference was that there were armed whites that actually attacked federal marshals. Several dozens of federal marshals were wounded before the federal troops came in. But then also under another Democratic president, Lyndon Johnson. Federal troops were sent into Washington, D.C. After the assassination of Martin Luther King and rioting in D.C. They were sent into Detroit, several other cities in 1967. So what is the difference between, as you're saying, what President Trump is claiming can do now versus some of these prior instances of not just National Guard, but actually federal troops being sent into states?
There's deep hypocrisy here. You bring up examples of white hostility and racism throughout our history that has torn apart communities and divided our nation. And those moments were moments where we needed federal intervention with all deliberate speed to ensure compliance with our civil rights laws. And here we are in 2020 dealing yet again with the failure to comply with civil rights laws. Police departments that abuse the civil rights of unarmed African Americans far too often. And, you know, it's quite remarkable when you think about Charlottesville and the hate rally that unfolded there in 2017 that resulted in harm to individuals and loss of life, the loss of Heather Heyer's life. And President Trump's reaction then couldn't be any different. There he referred to the violent individuals who drove that rally as, you know, very fine people. And here he's essentially declaring war on people who are out solely to speak out against racial violence, against police violence. People who are saying enough is enough. People who are saying that we see these incidents time and time again captured on video, and we refuse to allow you to turn a blind eye to this any longer. And the killing of George Floyd, you know, these images have gone viral across our country, across the globe. It's the straw that broke the camel's back. And here we are, you know, people all across our country who are speaking out. And it is most unfortunate that President Trump seeks to shut them down and silence them with the threat of deploying the military.
This is President Trump speaking Monday during a call with the nation's governors.
Get a lot of men. We have all the men and women that you need. The people aren't calling them up. You have to dominate. If you don't dominate, you're wasting your time. They're going to run over you. You're going to look like a bunch of jerks. You have to dominate. And you have to arrest people, and you have to try people. And they have to go to jail for long periods of time.
So that's President Trump speaking to the governors who were pushing back. Bill Arkin, you have been writing about this, longtime reporter on military and nuclear policy, what Trump's plans are. Now he's announced them, though he hasn't actually invoked the act. But can you talk about what you understand the plans to be from your sources?
Thank you for having me on, Amy. I think it's important to say at this moment that the Insurrection Act has not been evoked. And what the president has done is he's made a threat. He's made a threat to the governors that says if you're not able to safeguard civilian lives and property, and if you refuse to protect the civil rights of your citizens, then the federal government will intervene. That's the provisions of the Insurrection Act as it reads. Now, that's not the only condition under which the president can call federal forces out. And in the case of the District of Columbia, for instance, he's already activated the District of Columbia National Guard in federal status. So, in fact, we now have a National Guard in our country as of yesterday under federal control. And there have been military police and infantry soldiers moved from Fort Drum, New York, from Fort Riley, Kansas, and from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to the D.C. area. And they're now mustering at military bases at what's called Force Protection Condition Delta, the highest condition, ready to take control of Washington, D.C., if the president so orders. So we have this very fluid and difficult situation because there are already 20,000 National Guardsmen and women on the streets of America. The Guard has been mobilized in 26 different states and the District of Columbia. But I want to say this about the military being on the streets. In many cases, we've seen instances where the National Guard has played a calming role. For instance, I saw news stories last night out of Tennessee where the National Guardsmen of the Tennessee National Guard put down their shields and stood quietly and unarmed in front of a crowd and was actually serving in a calming presence. The military also, I think, has the ability to relieve police forces who have now been fighting protesters and rioters for going on five nights. So there could be some usefulness in having the National Guard and the military. The problem here is President Trump and his both lack of knowledge and indifference to what the law actually requires the president to do. And I would say the problem is the Defense Department leadership, Secretary of Defense Esper and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, who I think have provided terrible military advice to the president and no pushback, that's what I'm hearing from my sources, in terms of saying to him that the activation of those National Guard forces under federal control and the intervention of federal military forces onto the streets of America would actually be inflammatory rather than calming. So I think the National Guard, as it's currently deployed, that is under governor control in 26 different states, and there are additional National Guard units now being activated, that is enough, and that the idea that the federal government has to intervene, particularly the federal government law enforcement authorities, which number in the tens of thousands, I think is an escalation that would just make the situation worse on the ground.
And William Markin, I wanted to pursue this point that you mentioned in terms of sometimes the National Guard can create a calming situation. I recall back because I was there in 1992 at the Los Angeles riots, after the Rodney King situation when the police were acquitted in the beating of Rodney King. And back then, by the time the guard came in, there were already 62 people killed, 63 people killed in Los Angeles. Over 12,000 people had been arrested. And there was hundreds of millions, as much as $1 billion in damage to L.A. We're seeing some disturbances in many cities and some looting, but nothing at the scale that would require a massive military presence. And I'm wondering your sense of this question of proportionality in terms of the government response, because by the time the guard came into L.A., there was a sense by the residents of Los Angeles of almost relief because there had been so much tension between the community and the local police and the commissioner then, Daryl Gates, that the guard were almost seen as a neutral force to some degree.
Well, there's two things to remember. One, when one talks about the National Guard, in most states are the very citizens and neighbors of those states. And so when the National Guard comes into Los Angeles, in the case there where the governor of California requested the National Guard to come in, requested President Bush activate the National Guard under federal control and bring them in, those were Californians. And it really does make a difference to people on the ground that there are local people who are involved. I think the danger of bringing federal government troops into a state is that they're not locals, and therefore they see their role and they see the world in a different way. They see it more as the military stupidly said yesterday, Secretary Esper, you know, the battle space of America. Well, it's not a battle space. This is not a combat zone. And as far as we've seen everywhere around the country, it may be the case that the resources of local police are in fact going to be exhausted, especially if rioting continues over many more days, in which case the National Guard does provide a fresh force and does provide a different face. And especially, I think, for African Americans in America, I don't think the military necessarily is an opponent, whereas many African Americans see the police as the opponent. So,
Bill Arkin, you tweeted federal surveillance aircraft, helicopters, and drones from the DHS Gov and the FBI, plus the military, have flown over at least 8 cities last night, conducting reconnaissance, taking photos and videos of protests.
The federal government has done many things, including the monitoring of social media, the intercepting of phone calls, the intercepting of cell phones, the use of cell phones to locate people, the use of drones, surveillance aircraft flown by the FBI, by Customs and Border Protection, and by the military, including helicopters that have been flying over U.S. cities conducting surveillance missions. This has all been done in the last 24 to 48 hours, and it is a questionable use of the military force. But up in the air and doing that surveillance, if in fact it's done under the governor's control and feeding that information to the governors in order for them to be able to command their forces to get better situational awareness and improve.
But clearly the governors were fighting back in their call against President Trump last night, a number of the governors, as he was talking about dominating the people of the United States. Juan?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Kristen Clark. This is, of course, not the first time that President Trump, in the midst of another crisis, has suddenly resorted to calling out the military. I'm thinking earlier in his administration, the bringing out of troops to the border with Mexico, and again, overusing the military in an attempt to deal with another political problem that he had. I'm wondering, do you see parallels as well between his response to immigration and the use of troops and now to protests against police abuse?
Well, there's weaponization of tools at his disposal at every turn, and his use of social media. President Trump's use of social media is perhaps the best example of how he has, you know, weaponized this platform to incite violence and to escalate tensions across our country. I do indeed see parallels. You know, I just want to make sure that I underscore, though, that we can't lose sight. We can't lose sight of what's at the heart of these demonstrations and protests. And it is the public crying out for desperately needed reform of the way policing is carried out in our country. And we have a roadmap for this. We have studied this issue time and time again. And at my organization, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, we are pushing Congress. We are urging states right now to work on things like bans on chokeholds, bans on racial profiling. We need Congress to revise a federal statute, 18 U.S.C. 242, which would make it easier to hold police officers accountable when they use deadly force against unarmed individuals. We need a database so that we can track bad cops who are purged from one police department so that they don't jump right over to the next. Racism infects every stage of our criminal justice system in the United States. And now is the time that we confront this crisis head on. And we need not be distracted by President Trump's invocations of executive orders, dangling of threats of prosecuting people and throwing the book at them, invoking, if not literally, figuratively, the Insurrection Act of 1807. In my view, many of these actions by President Trump are intended to derail the underlying objective and goals of demonstrations and protests, which have been very intentional and clear in their focus.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Kristen Clark, president of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and William Arkin, longtime reporter on military and nuclear policy. When we come back, we go to Los Angeles to speak with Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors, author of When They Call You a Terrorist. Stay with us.
Overcome emancipation, rides majestic through our nation, bearing on its frame the story, liberty and nation's glory.
Boogie along, boogie along, boogie along, through the nation, freedom's car, emancipation. Boogie along, boogie along, boogie along, through the nation, freedom's car, emancipation.
nation, clear the track, emancipation. Get out the way, get out the way, get out the way. Manifestation, clear the track, emancipation.
To emancipation cannot rest on clay foundation, and the road that Poker wrecks us leads to slavery and Texas.
Pull up the rails, pull up the rails, pull up the rails. Emancipation cannot rest on such foundation. Pull up the rails, pull up the rails, pull up the rails. Emancipation cannot rest on such foundation.
With old Abe to go before us and the flag of freedom o'er us, we will shout the sounding chorus. We're for freedom and reform.
With old Abe, with old Abe, with old Abe to go before us, we're for freedom and reform. With old Abe, with old Abe, with old Abe to go before us, we're for freedom and reform. See the people run to meet us, and the deepest peasants greet us. All take seats with exultation in the car, emancipation. Huzzah, 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 huzzah. Emancipation to bless our happy nation. Huzzah, huzzah.
Track, a prominent song of the 1840s abolitionist struggle, made famous by the Hutchinson Family Singers of New Hampshire, performed here by the Dutchess Anti-Slavery Singers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we go now to Los Angeles, where protesters took to the streets of downtown and Hollywood on Monday, another day of mass protests against police brutality and the murder of George Floyd. Demonstrators briefly shut down the 405 freeway in West L.A., and Van Nuys looting broke out near a peaceful protest organized by students. Monday marked the third night of a countywide curfew in Los Angeles, where protests have been widespread and resulted in thousands of arrests. The wealthy enclaves of Beverly Hills and Santa Monica set 1 p.m. curfews after protests reached their neighborhoods. On Sunday, hundreds were arrested in a mass protest in Santa Monica that left many storefronts destroyed. Calls are growing for the firing of the LAPD chief, Michael Moore, who said Monday that looters were as responsible for George Floyd's death as the police officers who killed him.
We had protests last night. We had criminal acts. We had people mourning the death of this man, George Floyd. We had people capitalizing. His death is on their hands, as much as it is those officers.
The Los Angeles Police Chief Michael Moore has since apologized for his statements. Mayor Eric Garcetti tweeted, "The responsibility for George Floyd's death rests solely with the police officers involved. Chief Moore regrets the words he chose this evening and has clarified them." This comes as Mayor Garcetti is facing criticism for increasing funding for the Los Angeles Police Department in a budget for the coming fiscal year. Community members are demanding the City Council act to enact a people's budget that slashes money for police and invests in services for the community instead. Well, for more, we're going to Los Angeles, where we're joined by Patrice Cullors, political strategist, co-founder of Black Lives Matter, founder of Reform LA Jail. She's the co-author of When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Patrice. It's great to have you with us. Can you respond first to the death of George Floyd and then to the massive police anti-police brutality protests and the police response?
Sure. It's really good to be here, Amy, and thank you so much for having me on. I think, you know, I just start with my deep condolences to George Floyd's family and the community of Minneapolis. Once again, we see the devastation and the impact of the killing and torture of Black communities. And so I just want to start there. I think these protests are massive and the way that we haven't seen them in years for a number of reasons. Number one, we've had to live under 4 years of a Trump regime that has completely devastated communities financially, spiritually, emotionally. And number two, we have still dealt with years of police brutality, police violence, and police terror with no accountability whatsoever. And this generation is tired. Enough is enough.
And Patrice Collars, you recently went back and watched some footage of the 1992 Rodney King uprising. What struck you the most about those events?
Well, I think it's, you know, there's two things happening in our city right now in Los Angeles. One is massive protest in solidarity with Minneapolis, but also talking about what's happening in our own town. There's been 601 deaths since 2012 involved specifically with police officers killing civilians. And we have had a DA here, Jackie Lacey, who has not prosecuted a single officer and has been largely unaccountable to the community. And as Amy said earlier, 54% of LA City's budget is actually LAPD's budget. And the community is over false promises. We're over having to deal with elected officials who, instead of listening to Black pain and grief, send out the National Guard, you know, create more havoc in our communities.
Patrice Collars, can you talk about the budget that has just been unveiled and what you're demanding, where you think money needs to be spent at this point, and also where you see these protests going?
Sure. Our local chapter, Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, led by Malina Abdullah, really has been the group that has been focusing on the city budget specifically. For years, we have seen the unveiling of the city budget, and it is always prioritized LAPD's money first. And it's deprioritized everything else, all the social services that our communities need. So what we're asking for is a slashing of LAPD's budget. We don't believe that LAPD needs that much money. We're really, the national demand, as you'll see, is a defunding of law enforcement. Minneapolis is calling for it. Los Angeles is calling for it. Chicago is calling for it. DC is calling for it. We have created a system that over relies on law enforcement and prioritizes their money, their budget, their needs over everything else. Now is the time that we redirect resources back into our communities.
And Patrice Collars, I'm wondering, the response of the police in many of these cities now, we're seeing increasing aggressive moves by police, whether it's in New York or in Louisville or in other cities, against peaceful demonstrators. To what extent do you feel that the police across the country, many of them, have been emboldened by the language and the demeanor of President Trump over these last 4 years, that they feel that they have basically the backing of the White House if they have to exert a much more authoritarian force in their local cities?
Absolutely. I mean, we know Trump's history. We know how he has impacted just by way of how he communicates, just how he uses the media to stoke fear in mostly white affluent communities. He's aligned himself historically with the police, being law and order. He just went on the news yesterday telling people that he's going to send the military into cities. This is a man who would encourage people being beat up, counter-protesters that would come into his rallies when he was running for president. This is a man who told law enforcement at a huge law enforcement conference that they should be beating up people. And we know that he is in complete agreement with law enforcement terrorizing and using aggressive tactics like rubber bullets, like tear gas. On Saturday at our protest that we launched, Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, along with Build Power, for 2 hours it was full of passion, full of love, and we marched together. The minute that march got violent is when the police showed up They started shooting into the crowd, rubber bullets. They started batoning people. It was disturbing, and it was scary, and it was so obvious that they feel emboldened right now.
How do you respond, Patrice, to police officers showing solidarity with the protesters? On Monday, you have one of New York City's top officers, Terrence Monaghan, taking a knee, hugging a protester during a rally in Washington Square Park. In Flint, Michigan, the Genesee County Sheriff Chris Swanson marched with protesters on Saturday. In Green Bay, Wisconsin, Police Chief Andrew Smith condemned the killing of George Floyd and walked with protesters. And we're seeing this amidst the tear gassing, amidst the shooting, amidst the pepper spraying and the massive number of thousands of arrests. Your comments?
It's like a really frightening, abusive relationship. It's when you're in an abusive relationship and the partner is gaslighting you and telling you that everything that you're feeling is not true. And look what I'm doing for you. It's not acceptable behavior, honestly. You're either going to be in solidarity with the community and stop brutalizing us, or you're going to continue to do what you've been doing in business as usual. But there's no half-stepping. Taking a knee, marching with protesters, that doesn't actually change the structure. It doesn't change our system that we live in, which is a system that continues to violate the rights of Black people, continues to kill Black people, hunt Black people, and traumatize Black people. That's what law enforcement has done for years. And these new acts of solidarity are, they don't sit well with many of us.
Let me ask you, we talked to you about the film Bedlam, which very much focused on you, Patrice, and your brother Monty. So all of these mass protests are taking place amidst the pandemic. They could be super spreading events, the horror of what could happen and particularly impacting Black and Latino and Native American communities. And I'm wondering, actually, what has happened with your brother, Monty, who lives with schizoaffective disorder since he was a teenager, in the midst of all this, the pandemic, the police brutality, protests?
Well, we were lucky enough to get Monty off the streets last fall, and he was hospitalized for quite a bit of time as I received conservatorship of him, and he ended up going to a mental health facility. So that's where he's at now. The facility has not experienced a COVID-19 outbreak, although there has been some COVID-19 patients. He is doing well right now, and he is safe, and that feels really important to me, especially given what's happening right now.
And Patrice, I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you can answer this from your perspective, but I've been noticing in the reports that have been coming out about the protests and also about some of the looting and the vandalism that's broken out, that it's not just occurring in the major cities, but for instance, in the Chicago suburbs, faraway suburbs that from the major city like Aurora, Cicero, and others, have also seen strange incidents of looting that have gone on. Do you have some concern that there may be some attempts to deliberate attempts to provoke violence, to stir up greater animosity among some sectors of the American community?
Absolutely. We know that there are three sets of folks who are out in the streets. There are protesters, those of us who are fighting against police brutality and police terror. There are white supremacists, those who are exploiting Black pain in this moment and really trying to undermine our protests. And then there's police who sometimes act as protesters, so undercovers, and also uniformed officers who have created significant amount of distress and havoc and confusion and protests. We have to be careful when we're protesting, both with COVID-19, but also because there are times where there's agent provocateurs and there's different people who have a different agenda than what our movement actually has.
We want to thank you, Patrice, for joining us. Patrice Cullors, political strategist, co-founder of Black Lives Matter, founder of Reform LA Jails. She is the author of When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir. When we come back, two autopsies agree George Floyd's death was a homicide. We'll go to Minneapolis for response. Stay with us.
Some people die for honor. Some people die for love. Some people die while singing to the heavens above. Some people die believing in the cross on Calvary Hill. And some people die in the blink of an eye for a $20 bill.
$20 bill for George Floyd by Tom Prasado Rao. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in Minneapolis, where protesters continue to take to the streets to demand justice for George Floyd, African-American man killed by white police officer Derek Chauvin last week, when Chauvin pinned him to the ground, pressing his knee into his neck for nearly 9 minutes, as Floyd repeatedly said, "I can't breathe." A number of those minutes, he was lifeless. The viral video of the murders sparked nationwide uprising against police. Two separate autopsies Monday confirmed Floyd's death was a homicide. Derek Chauvin was charged Friday with third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. The three other officers who were fired along with Chauvin have not been charged, even as new video appears to show two of them also kneeling on George Floyd's body as he laid on the pavement. George Floyd's memorial service is planned for Thursday in Minneapolis, his funeral scheduled for Tuesday in Houston. On Monday, George Floyd's younger brother Terrence called for peace from the site of his brother's murder.
If I'm not over here wilding out, if I'm not over here blowing up stuff,
I'm out.
If I'm not over here messing up my community,
come on.
Then what are y'all doing? What are y'all doing? Y'all doing nothing, because that's not gonna bring my brother back at all. I know. He would not want y'all to be doing this.
Comes one day after Minnesota Governor Tim Walz announced Attorney General Keith Ellison will take the lead in the investigation and any prosecutions related to George Floyd's killing. George Floyd's family is calling for the other three officers involved in the killing to be charged. For more, we're joined by Nikema Levy Armstrong, civil rights attorney, activist, founder of the Racial Justice Network, former president of the Minneapolis chapter of the NAACP. If you can talk, Nikema Levy Armstrong, and thanks so much for joining us once again, about these latest developments. The announcement of the second independent autopsy, which says that George Floyd died by asphyxiation, but also confirming what the coroner said, this was a homicide. And then talk about Keith Ellison, the now attorney general, first Muslim member of Congress, taking over the prosecution and what's happening there.
I don't think that most of us are surprised that the county medical examiner tried to find a reason related to why George Floyd died that distanced it from law enforcement's role. So, for example, if you think back to the night that George Floyd died, the police issued a press release that we know was a bogus press release claiming that George Floyd died as a result of a medical incident. And so the county medical examiner's report is consistent with this notion that an underlying medical condition caused his death, whereas the autopsy that was conducted independently by the family of George Floyd shows that he died as a result of asphyxiation related to the officer holding his knee on George Floyd's neck for several minutes and not allowing him the opportunity to breathe. I think what this does is illustrates the corruption that exists within Hennepin County where you have law enforcement working collaboratively with the county medical examiner's office, working collaboratively with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and ultimately resulting in people not being able to get justice when they are killed by police. This happens time and time again. Many of these cases are ruled as a homicide, but that has not resulted in justice for victims of police violence, victims of police shootings, and in this case, victims of asphyxiation as a result of police conduct. Now, recently it was... go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
Recently, it was announced that Congressman, former Congressman Keith Ellison, now Minnesota Attorney General, is going to take over the case. And I mean, for many of us, we are glad that the case will no longer be in the hands of Mike Freeman. However, when Keith Ellison said that he would be taking over the case, he claimed that he would be working collaboratively with Mike Freeman's office. So that has raised our antenna as activists, as well as attorneys who care about social justice, because we know that Mike Freeman has routinely failed to hold police officers accountable who kill civilians. And so we're saying Mike Freeman should have no role in this case whatsoever. Even if you look at the original charging decision, he is charged Chauvin, who is the main cop who has been arrested and the one seen in the video with his knee on George Floyd's neck. He's charged him with third degree murder, which is similar to someone randomly shooting into a crowd, not having a specific person that they're targeting, and that person dying. Minnesota case law has shown that you can't sustain a third degree murder conviction in a situation like the one at hand, where George Floyd is the victim, he was the intended target, and he died as a result of the police officer's conduct. So even the charging decision by the Hennepin County attorney is really setting this case up to be dismissed for lack of probable cause, or ultimately for the case to result in Officer Chauvin or former Officer Chauvin being exonerated, which we find to be unacceptable.
And Nakima Levy Armstrong, the most recent video that shows that not only the one officer in the previous video, Chauvin was actually had his knee on the victim's neck, but that two other officers also had their knees down on his chest and his torso. Do you think that that's sufficient right there to charge them with having been involved in the killing?
Absolutely. It's a no-brainer. I mean, we've had medical professionals from around the country weighing in on social media, raising concerns about what happened and calling what occurred to George Floyd murder. This is why we have been demanding that all four officers be charged now by Keith Ellison, because, again, we want the case completely taken out of the hands of the Hennepin County attorney. But beyond that, I need to talk a little bit about our concerns regarding Keith Ellison. We do not feel that Keith Ellison will be impartial enough to directly oversee prosecution in this case. So what we are calling for is the appointment of a completely independent special prosecutor to oversee this case, preferably someone from outside the state of Minnesota with a strong national reputation, a person who's credible, a person who is known for being fair and just.
We have 10 seconds.
In cases like this.
Nakima Levy Armstrong, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Civil rights attorney, activist, founder of the Racial Justice Network, former president of the Minneapolis chapter of the NAACP. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our remarkable team is working from home. If you'd like to sign up for our daily digest, our daily newsletter, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamara Studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.